With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire, and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. A little girl is placed into foster care. Everything seems to be going okay for a while, but eventually she stops showing up for school. Then it's missed doctor's appointments and a missed paternity test. Then it's over 2 years since anyone has seen her. There have been several similar cases in the news lately. Oakley Carlson, whom we've covered here, as well as Harmony Montgomery. But this case goes even further back. Brittany Williams was a 7-year-old girl who was eventually reported missing back in 2003. But she hadn't been seen by anyone in public since August 18th, 2000. While investigators thought that Brittany had likely died, everything changed in 2021 when a woman came forward saying that she had a DNA test that proved she was Brittany Williams. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Brittany Williams. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. So for those of you who are on our Patreon, we released a little behind the scenes video in which we talked about our challenge recording this episode and potentially recording future episodes. Ethan and I both have COVID right now.
Yay, COVID recording.
Yeah, so he's actually congested, so his voice might be a little bit off today.
I think it sounds sexier.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm asymptomatic, so I have no excuse for the way I sound, but we're pushing through it right now. So again, thanks for your patience. As many of you know, we're based in Virginia, and so that was one of the things that interested me about today's case, because everything here takes place just a few hours from us down in Richmond.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I used to, I used to live in Richmond, but way before any of this took place.
Where haven't you lived?
I know, I moved around a lot. I wasn't aware of Brittany's story until last year when a woman posted in one of the missing persons Facebook groups that I'm a member of that her wife had a DNA test proving that she was Brittany Williams, who was this little girl who had been missing and presumed dead for nearly 20 years.
Yeah, when you said that, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Do we actually have a case where there's a potential happy ending?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what I thought. I was like, holy shit. Like, when I saw that post come through, like, that was crazy. And yeah, this woman, she was like, yeah, my wife is Brittany Williams. Like, we have the proof. And, you know, it was bananas. You know, just one of those things that you never think is going to happen.
So I'm assuming that there's more to it than that. Otherwise, we wouldn't be covering this case, right?
Story's over, the end.
Yeah.
Everybody go back to sleep. There's a lot more to it. So we're going to talk about Brittany, what happened with her. And again, you know, that was the other reason I wanted to cover this, because we did recently cover the Oakley Carlson case. If you guys listen to Voices for Justice, which is hosted by Sarah Turney, it's an amazing show. So you should definitely be listening to it. She actually just released her second part of a two-part episode on Harmony Montgomery, which is an infuriating case. And she's doing, I haven't listened to the second part yet, but I've listened to the first, and she's doing an amazing job with it. But the thing is that both of these little girls were failed by the system and just weren't checked in on and were able to just be missing for an incredibly long amount of time before anybody even noticed. And so that's exactly what happened here with Brittany. And, you know, this was over 20 years ago. So the situation hasn't gotten better. These are systemic problems that, you know, I'm hoping by talking about, again, like I've said before in cases like this, like I said in the Oakley case, like I said in the Orrin and Orson Welles case, like my hope is that by talking about these and bringing attention to them, that people understand that this isn't just an issue with a particular state or a particular agency or even a particular time period.
Look, the system is broken. So I was a social worker probably 19 years ago.
Right.
As a social worker, you do your best, but, you know, things get missed. And I'm not making excuses for the social workers, but, like, it's a tough system to work in. It's a tough system to be involved with. And it almost feels like nobody's really looking out for the kids.
Yeah, it's crazy. And this is a unique case for a couple of reasons. One, Brittany was medically fragile. And two, but actually so is Harmony Montgomery. But two, this didn't involve a traditional foster care placement. This involved a private foster home.
I hate every word that you just said. Privatized foster care?
Yeah.
I mean, we see how privatized prisons are going. Do you think that privatized foster care, aka just like child sex trafficking, is going to work out well?
Yeah. So we're going to get into this, that whole situation too, obviously. So it's a disaster. With this case, you know, I found out about it when this woman came forward last year, and I almost like immediately, you know, grabbed you and hopped on the mic and did like a bonus episode, you know, like, oh my God, like this girl has been found after 20 years. But, you know, I like figured it would make more sense to get a little more information, like wait until we figured out exactly what's going on. And I'm glad I did because like it's taken a lot of twists and turns. So now, you know, it's time, I think, that we can really just dig in and talk about this whole thing.
All right, well, let's do it. Let's get into
it. But well, before we do, I do want to take a moment to thank our newest Patreon members, Elise L and Jeanette M. Thank you very much for your support.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I know our schedule's been wonky lately, and I know it's been disappointing, so it really does mean a lot to us. So right now, let's get to the story of Brittany Williams. Brittany Renee Williams was born on March 20th, 1993, in Virginia to Rosemarie Thompson. Rosemarie had a difficult life, and she was plagued with substance use issues. When Brittany was born, Rose already had one daughter, a girl named Anastasia. Anastasia eventually went into the foster care system and was adopted, but I'm not sure on the timeline of that. So I don't know if, I actually don't even know what the age difference is between the two of them. So I don't know if Anastasia was already in the system by this point or if Rosemarie had custody of her then. But eventually, both children would go into the system. When Rosemarie was about 6 months pregnant with Brittany, she received devastating news. She was HIV positive. Rosemarie's HIV status quickly evolved into AIDS, and her health deteriorated very quickly after Brittany's birth. And Brittany herself was diagnosed as HIV positive. From what I read, there is only at this point, the numbers are a lot different. Since 1993, when Brittany was born, to now 2022, I mean, there are a lot more drug options and therapies that can be given to pregnant HIV positive women. But at the time, there was about a 25% chance that the mother would pass the disease on to her child in utero. So unfortunately, Brittany was part of that 25%. Now, Brittany had many medical needs that came along with this diagnosis, and most sources do say that her HIV also progressed to AIDS. At one point, she needed a feeding tube along with other medical intervention.
And how old was she when all of that was
I mean, this basically happened from birth. And so she was just a toddler, I think, when she had to get a portacath inserted in her chest.
Wow.
And again, like other surgeries and medical intervention measures. During the first few years of Britney's life, not only did Rosemary get sicker with her disease, you know, like I said, progressing to AIDS, but it sounds like she may have still been using drugs. As a result, Britney was in and out of foster care. In addition to traditional foster care placements, Britney also spent some time at a place called Rainbow Kids, Inc. Rainbow Kids was a home in Henrico County run by Kim Parker. She specialized in caring for medically fragile children, including children who are HIV positive. Over the years that Rainbow Kids operated, I want to say it was like around 15 years, but over 50 kids, 50, came through Kim Parker's home.
Well, when you say came through, like in and out of the foster care system or just in and out of her home?
Well, I think both. And then I think also some of the children passed away.
Oh.
Because they were very sick.
Right.
Not all of them. You know, some of them just had special needs, you know, and not terminal illnesses, but some did have terminal illnesses. So, yeah, over the years, about 50 kids came through. And then when the investigation started into Britney's disappearance in 2003, Kim had two children living with her, a 22-month-old child and a 14-year-old child.
That's quite a span between the two.
Yeah. As Rosemary's health declined, she formed more of a relationship with Kim, and she wanted her to be the one to take care of Britney permanently after she was gone. Britney's father was not at all in the picture. In 1996, when Britney was around 3 years old, Rosemary signed guardianship over to Kim, and she died shortly thereafter. Now, this wasn't a traditional foster placement, so those home checks that we've talked about in so many other episodes weren't in place. But nor was it an official adoption, which would have meant that Kim had the same rights as a biological parent. It was a guardianship, so I'm not sure if that came with any oversight from the state of Virginia.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have any insight on that. I mean, I don't even remember ever dealing with that in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Like I said, like 18, 19 years ago now.
Yeah. So I don't know. But it seems like it pretty much just served to give Kim the authority to make medical decisions and to receive Britney's Social Security and Medicaid benefits.
I mean, you would think that there should be some oversight of that. Some oversight of Kim's home, some right. oversight of the situation.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, because again, there were other children. Britney wasn't the only one. And it's not like she had legal guardianship over all of them. So I'm wondering if the foster, you know, if like DCFS was involved, if social workers were involved, but like with other kids.
They would have had to have been at some point because she, I'm assuming some other children were placed there.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. So yeah.
And if they're in the system, then there has to be in theory, a social yeah. worker assigned. So what happened to Britney's social worker?
Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea.
Cause I mean, even though the legal guardianship passed to Kim, Britney should still have a social worker. She should still have an open case if she was in the system.
Yeah, and we get a little bit more into that later on, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do know that social services did get involved prior to Britney's disappearance, and I believe after, but for different reasons. So Kim Parker's charity, Rainbow Kids, Inc., as in incorporated.
Yeah, I picked up on that.
Yeah. Generally not how charities are named, right. You know, actual 501c3 nonprofits. It was not a registered nonprofit, as you may have guessed. It was basically just something she made up in order to like sound official. This was her home that she was running this out of. Like, this is basically, you know, just like somebody running a home daycare center, except like she wasn't licensed in any way either, nor was she a nonprofit.
Which leads me to another question is how did social services start placing kids there?
Yeah, so I'm wondering if maybe she was a licensed foster parent.
Yeah.
But like the charity, in quotes, itself was not a registered nonprofit or like a licensed child care center or whatever. Mm. So yeah, again, it's murky. It's very murky. You could almost write some of that off as like, well, maybe she didn't have all the proper paperwork, because it really is very difficult to and time consuming to register something as a 501c3. So maybe you're like, well, you know, she didn't have the proper paperwork, but she was doing a good thing. She wasn't really even doing a good thing, though, as it turns out. She wasn't providing a very healthy environment for these children. The home was absolutely filthy, and Kim was reported several times to social services for abuse and neglect.
Okay, so here we have a specialized, quote unquote, foster parent,
right?
Who specializes in children that have emotional and physical needs,
mm-hmm.
and she gets reported for abuse and neglect.
Yes,
I think at that point you stop sending kids there.
Yeah, that is not apparently what happened, though, because at the very least, I do know that some of these reports happened prior to, you know, when I mentioned that the 22-month-old and the 14-year-old were living there. So yes, this did not stop it. Furthermore, the findings from social services were never released to the public, which is not surprising because they very, very rarely are. And they have since been destroyed.
Cool.
Yeah. So they no longer exist. So anybody's a guess.
So much for FOIA.
Yeah, well, exactly. So Brittany remained in Kim's care for the next 4 years. So again, she...
Legal guardian.
That happened in 96 when Rosemary died. At some point during this time, Kim started using some of the money that she was getting in benefits for Brittany and I'm assuming the other children, totaling around $18,000. And she used it to do upgrades on her home. And again...
Okay. I mean, yeah. You know, the questionable decision, but... I mean, she's at least putting it back into the nonprofit business that she's making a profit off of.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. And I mean, I just know that from a tax standpoint because, you know, I use a home office.
Well, careful what you're about to say, honey. We might get audited here. Come on.
No, but like there is a thing that like, you know, any... Because I use part of my home for my business, any home improvements I make, I can write off a portion of that as a business expense.
Right.
Because, you know, it's just, like I said, like my home, you know, my office is here. So I can kind of see it from that general thing, because you're right. Like any business, whether it's a nonprofit, whether it's a for-profit business, like you need to keep up the infrastructure, right?
Right.
And in this particular case, the upgrades, you know, or whatever that she was doing to the house was she built an addition, which on its face would make sense, right? You know, that because it seems like it was a pretty small house. And so, you know, you need more room for kids. Like that on its face isn't incredibly scandalous to me, I guess. In hindsight, it obviously looks very bad. Henrico County Deputy Commonwealth's Attorney Mike Feenmel said of Parker, quote, "The money coming in was how she was living," end quote. Brittany's childhood friend, Sarah Minter, lived just two blocks away from Kim Parker's house. She said that Brittany was a sweet, vibrant child and told reporters, quote, "She was soft-spoken and had the biggest smile you'd ever want to see." Though her mother was dead and the man Rosemary said was Brittany's father was in prison, Brittany still had a family member nearby, her aunt, Brenda Martin. Brenda, who was Rosemary's half-sister, remained close with Brittany. She was around when Rosemary and Kim first met at the hospital where she and Brittany were receiving AIDS treatment.
But Brenda didn't or couldn't care for Brittany?
No, she couldn't. And we actually talk about that a little bit later because that does come up. But no, she was not able to take Brittany in. But
I also didn't mean for it to sound as, I don't know.
Like accusatory?
Yeah.
Well, no, and I get that because I think that's everybody's natural first question. You have a close relative. But yeah, she wasn't able to take Brittany in, but she did, you know, help out as much as she could.
Got it.
Though Rosemary clearly took a liking to Kim, Brenda said that she always thought there was something off about the woman. She was just one of those people who was like relentlessly kind in a way that did not feel genuine to Brenda. She told NBC 12 in 2019, quote, she basically just pounced on them. You know, I can do this for you. I can do that for you, end quote.
Perhaps a little too eager to get Brittany under her care.
Yeah. And that's kind of like what Brenda thought, but obviously not, you know, the vibe that Rosemary got. Brenda would regularly visit Brittany at the Rambo kids' home. She said that while there were a few times that she would come over in the morning and Brittany would seem sad as she was getting on the school bus, overall, Brittany was a very happy child. She was also very aware of her disease. Brenda says that one day Brittany broke a plate and cut her hand. Brenda went to go help her niece, but Brittany said, quote, no, you can't do that because of the blood. I'll take care of it, end quote. Despite the calls to social services in the home that Brenda confirmed was filthy, everything seemed to be going relatively okay until the summer of 2000, when Brenda received a bizarre and distressing phone call from Kim. Kim called Brenda and said that she couldn't handle Brittany anymore, and she wanted Brenda to take her. She told Brenda that she couldn't handle the little girl who was 7 by this time. She also said, and get ready for this, that Brittany was flirting with the men who were coming to work on the house.
A 7-year-old flirting?
7. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sounds like every child molester that's ever come up with that excuse saying that they were flirting with her, with them.
Yeah. If that's not disgusting enough, according to Brenda, Kim followed this accusation up with, quote, she's going to be like her mother, end quote.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
As the conversation went on, it seems as though Kim inadvertently revealed what the real problem was, that Brittany had lived longer than she expected her to.
Jesus, really?
Yeah. She was fine with taking in a toddler for a few years, collecting the money, and then moving on after her death, but Brittany remained healthy. And apparently, Kim was done dealing with her.
That's really fucked up.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's really bad. She told Brenda that if Brenda did not take Brittany, that she would give her away to 2 women who lived in California who had previously been volunteers at Rainbow Kids. So Brenda was obviously like aghast and completely thrown off guard by this entire conversation. And so like, I don't know how this call ended, you know, what?
Probably not good.
Well, exactly. I mean, but it did not end with Brenda agreeing to take Brittany. So 2 days later, you know, after I'm sure like Brenda was just stewing on this and trying to figure out what she could do, she called Kim back and, you know, she was hoping to work something out. She was going to tell her that she'd watch Brittany more, but that she couldn't adopt her because she already had 3 children at her home. Like, you know, she already had 3 kids. She was also a single mom. She was struggling and she just couldn't take on not only another child, but another child with the medical needs, the intense medical needs that Brittany had. But when she spoke with Kim, Kim told her, you're too late.
So what does that mean? Did she give her away?
In a word, yes. Brittany's last confirmed sighting was on August 18th, 2000, when Kim took Brittany to a routine doctor's appointment, but she was never seen again. After Kim told Brenda that she had, in fact, given Brittany away to those 2 women from California that she had mentioned on the phone before, Brenda, of course, like, went to Kim's house to confront her and, you know, just to see for herself, like if Brittany was there or what the hell was going on. But, you know, Kim wouldn't answer the door. She, of course, kept on trying to call. And then after that, Kim just stopped answering her calls. You know, she, at the very least, if this was true, Brenda wanted to get those women's contact information. 1, just to check on Brittany. And 2, so that, you know, if this was what was really happening, you know, she still wanted to keep in contact with her niece.
Sure.
But again, Kim refused to just answer any questions, give her any information whatsoever.
So did Brenda call the police or somebody?
It doesn't seem like it. Because it doesn't, yeah, it doesn't seem like Brenda made any sort of complaint to anyone. And I don't know why that is. You know, I don't know if she just was intimidated by the system, if she was intimidated by Kim, if, you know, there are just so many reasons. But yeah, so nothing really happened for a few months. Now, again, like I said, this is all taking place in August of 2000. Soon after, the school year starts up. And obviously, Brittany never went back to school. Now, interestingly, Kim also didn't withdraw her.
So the school didn't check up on her either.
Well, yeah, they did eventually. Obviously, not on like day one or whatever.
Sure.
But when she kept on not showing up for school in November, Kim was arrested for truancy.
So it took the school about 3 months before they actually acted on this?
Well, and I don't know what they were doing up until that point. I don't know if, you know, she had said like that Brittany was on vacation in California, if she was ill. I have no idea. None of that's ever been released publicly. All I do know is that, like I said, in November, they arrested her. But, you know, they had to. They don't just go from zero to arresting somebody, you know?
Yeah, no, I get that. But so now we've got 3 months of truancy and they arrest her. I guess go on. I'm assuming they start questioning where Brittany actually is.
Well, yeah. So she actually did have to make a court appearance. And that was the main question. Like, hey, where's Brittany? Why hasn't she been in school? She told the judge that Brittany had gone to live with relatives. And that was apparently good enough.
What?
Yeah, they dropped the charges.
Who were these relatives?
They didn't exist, obviously. But yeah, nobody checked. Nobody asked for, at that point, they didn't ask for contact information. They didn't ask for any proof. Yeah, they just were like, oh, okay, my bad. Sorry for the inconvenience. Bye.
What the hell?
After that, so the schools are out of it now, right? Because as far as the schools are concerned, you know, as far as Henrico County school system, like, Brittany is not a student there anymore. Not their problem. So that, you know, that check, like in terms of like checks and balances, like that one exits, right? So nobody asks any more questions for the next year.
Okay. Like, I get it. This is the judge is, I guess, a truancy judge,
right?
Truancy court, whatever, yeah. However you want to call that. But like just saying, oh, she's living with relatives. I mean, no follow-up to that at all? No, like,
yeah,
hey, maybe we should get children, youth, and families involved or social services of some kind involved in this to check up on her?
No, nothing. And, you know, I don't know. It could have been even like, oh, did she give us her address? She could have just written down any address, but like nobody followed up on it. They're just like, oh, here's an address on a piece of paper. Seems legit. Bye.
Wow.
Yeah. So that happened November 2000. Nothing happened for a year until 2001. And I don't know what precipitated this, but I mentioned before that the man who was supposed to be Brittany's father, biological father, was in prison. In 2001, she was scheduled to give a DNA sample for a paternity test. So I don't know, like I said, I don't know why that came up. I don't know if maybe Brenda was in touch with this man, was like, hey, like Brittany's missing. Like, is there something you can do about this? But he didn't have any proof that he was her father. Like, I have no idea. That's all wild speculation. But what I do know is that he was incarcerated at the time and Brittany was legally supposed to give this DNA sample. So Kim obviously did not produce Brittany for this DNA sample in 2001. And when she went in front of a judge once again, she told the same story. Brittany went off to live with family members.
Did that judge also just be like, all right, sounds good?
Yes. Yeah.
Two separate judges, two different courts.
Yeah. 2 years apart. I mean, well, 1 year apart, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jesus.
Authorities once again dropped the issue. This time for the next 2 years. And when it got brought up once again and an investigation was finally started, it wasn't because a social worker checked in. It wasn't because, you know, a concerned neighbor checked in. It wasn't because of anything like that. It was because of a reporter. So at some point, and I couldn't find any records of these news stories, unfortunately, like, you know, even in archives, but there had apparently been stories on some aspect of this, because in 2003, a newspaper reporter contacted Kim in an effort to do a follow-up on Brittany's story. When Parker told the same story that she had been telling authorities for the past like 2.5 years, this reporter didn't let it drop, unlike, you know, the judges and everybody else involved. The reporter took it upon herself to call social services, at which point, probably concerned about some bad press.
There you go.
Yep. A judge did order an investigation to be opened.
A little late.
Yeah. And this is at the beginning of 2003. So at this point, it's been nearly 2.5 years since Brittany has been seen by anybody. In February of 2003, Brittany was placed into the care of social services. And so this was part of this investigation. So the judge ordered that in order to allow the agency to work with police to find Brittany.
Right. So they removed the guardianship from Kim.
Yes.
And placed her theoretically in foster care.
Exactly. And so then they issue nationwide alerts with the child welfare and law enforcement agencies in every state. This is all coming out in the first newspaper article that I was able to find, which was in Stanton, Virginia's Daily News Leader on February 1st, 2003. Now, one infuriating detail from this article, other than people like the director of social services scratching his head and saying, literally, quote, "It is a very unusual, even bizarre situation," end quote. Like, fuck off, God. Like, that really irritated me. The other, you know, irritating detail is that Brittany had an advocate during this period. A lawyer named Teresa Reinhardt was appointed, quote, "some time ago by the court to be Brittany's guardian ad litem." Now, we've talked about these before in other episodes, but as a refresher, a guardian ad litem is someone who is supposed to be an independent third party who represents children's interests in court. So I don't know where the hell she was for the last 3 years. And when reporters reached out to her for this story, she refused to return their calls.
Well, yeah. I mean, because what would she say?
Yeah, exactly. And so I don't know if those previous two times that Kim had to go before judges, if this guardian ad litem was present, because it said that she, like I said, had been appointed some time ago. So, you know, she wasn't just appointed once the judge ordered custody to be pulled over to social services.
Right.
You know, so it seems like she should have been there at some point in this process, but apparently did fuck all to help Brittany. But once all this blew up, then she like hopped to attention. So she called Kim and ordered her to appear in court and provide, get ready, the names and addresses of the women she claims to have given Brittany to.
So you're just now requesting this after 3 years of not seeing her, and now there's a actual legal and police investigation, so now you have to do something.
Yeah.
Nice.
So Kim refused. And I have no idea why she did this. I mean, Kim talked to a reporter from the Richmond Times-Dispatch and told the reporter that she didn't know where Brittany was living and had no way of contacting her.
Okay. So did this guardian ad litem do anything with that? Did she bring that to a judge's attention?
Yeah, well, yes, this all did eventually get to the judge's attention, but the guardian ad litem didn't need to do that because Kim continued to talk to the reporter and told the reporter that Brittany was still with the women that she had given her to, and that she, Kim, had their temporary address in California. So the address that they were taking Brittany to back in 2000. But the three women, had all agreed that Kim wouldn't have any future addresses or telephone numbers. And this was apparently to prevent Brittany's incarcerated father from finding her.
Right. Because he was so active previous to this, like trying to get in touch with her.
Yeah. And again, I mean, okay, like I said, back with the paternity test, like maybe he was attempting to like gain access or do something. I have no idea. So like maybe there's something along those lines that's a possibility. But I mean, clearly that story is nonsense. But she went on.
Oh boy.
After this, you know, she pretty much never talks to reporters again, which, you know, you can understand why, because like, why is she saying any of this? So she also said that about a month after Brittany left, the women sent her a legal document signing over custody, but that she still expected that the arrangement was temporary and Brittany would be returned to her at some point.
None of that makes any sense.
No, of course it doesn't, you know, and, you know, the reason for this, like, exchange of custody does make sense because, you know, they needed it in order to get her medical care, right? And you do actually see that a lot. Logan Schindelman actually is another case that this is like the second time in the past few episodes I brought him up, but his grandmother had custody of him so that he could be on her insurance, right?
Sure.
So, sure. Gotcha. But overall, the story, even if there are certain teeny parts of it that could potentially make sense in some world, like this is not that world. So like, I don't know if this woman's mentally ill or just like shit at making up stories. But like you said, none of it makes sense. There's no evidence that Brittany's father had, you know, any real desire to find her other than this like paternity test in 2001. There's certainly no evidence that he like wanted to harm her or, you know, that him finding her would have been negative in any way. Like there's just nothing there. Kim also, of course, couldn't produce this legal document that she signed to give up custody. And, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty sure that you can't change legal guardianship just by signing a random document and sending it off in the mail like you're ordering sea monkeys from the back of a comic book in 1953.
That's quite a reference you just made there.
Kim was later finally arrested, but not for anything substantial. She was arrested for contempt of court. So basically, when the judge ordered the guardianship to be changed over to social services, Kim was supposed to physically produce Brittany so that that could happen. Obviously, she didn't. So she was arrested for contempt of court for failing to produce Brittany for that and for the 2001 DNA test, which, again, if that was such a big fucking deal, why didn't they arrest her back in 2001?
Right.
But, you know, whatever. So she's arrested for contempt, which is like a nonsense, bullshit, nothing charge. Police also were able, though, to get a warrant to search Kim's home. In the probable cause affidavit, it's revealed that Kim canceled Brittany's Medicaid coverage in September of 2002. And this constitutes medical neglect, because without that coverage, she could not get the medication and the medical attention that she needed. And so if Brittany were alive, whether she was living with Kim, whether she was living in California, it doesn't matter. That coverage could not be canceled. Also, turns out, once they started actually looking into this for 2.5 minutes, Kim continued to receive Brittany's Social Security benefits long after Brittany supposedly went to live in California.
Yeah, so that whole story about signing legal guardianship over to the other two women was bullshit.
Well, exactly. And we knew it was bullshit, obviously, but yeah. Like it's double bullshit because, again, nobody else ever got the Social Security benefits besides Kim, and the Medicaid coverage was canceled, not like transferred or anything right. else.
Yeah.
Oh, and then also during all of this, and I don't know if it was before or after Brittany was last seen, but at some point, Kim apparently tried to fraudulently raise money to build Brittany a wheelchair ramp.
Was she ever wheelchair bound?
Not that I know of, no. And I don't know if like there was a chance that she could have been at some, you know, like down the line or whatever. But yeah, like she was not in a wheelchair. And I think this fundraiser was actually after Brittany was already gone. Though the penalty for contempt of court was up to a year, on February 22nd, 2003, Kim was sentenced to just 20 days in jail and was eventually released on a $2,000 bond. And then her attorney immediately appealed the conviction and all of that. So during this time, investigators continued to search for Brittany. They, of course, found no trace of her at Kim's house. Now, at some point, and again, I'm not exactly sure when this was, but at some point, Kim at least told authorities, or authorities discovered the names of these two women. So these two women, like, actually did exist.
Okay.
Yeah. So they were real people. They weren't just, like, two women that she made up. Their names are Linda Hodges and Kathy Evans. So police tracked the women down in California. So that part, also true. Lived in California. And while they confirmed that they did know Brittany and had volunteered for Rainbow Kids, just like Kim had said, they said that they had never cared for her. Brittany had never stayed with them. They had no idea what the hell Kim was talking about. They had never had any conversations about Brittany, you know, coming to live with them. There had been like a conversation of a visit or something, but yeah, nothing even approaching any of this. Police eventually cleared the women, but, you know, they were a little invested by this point, and so they did kind of stay involved in the investigation and did go to some of the court dates. A potential terrible turn in this story happened soon after the investigation started. While they were looking for Brittany, in addition to, you know, like I said, putting alerts out to different social service agencies and things like that, they were also looking at, you know, unidentified bodies. There was an unidentified decapitated body of a black female child who was found near Kansas City, Missouri. The body had actually been found in 2001 and had remained unidentified up to that point, which was 2003. And this led some to believe that it could possibly be Brittany because, you know, the dates matched up.
Yeah, but was there evidence of... what was the medical port that she had?
Right, the port-a-cath scar on her chest. And... yeah, so that was the big thing. So the little girl who had been dubbed Precious Doe didn't seem to have that scar. She also had a crescent-shaped birthmark on her shoulder that Brittany's Aunt Brenda said that she had never seen on Brittany. Investigators ended up taking a DNA sample from the man named on Brittany's birth certificate, the one who I mentioned who was in prison, and they sent it off to see if it was a match. It was not a match. And, you know, again, like that would actually not fill me with a lot of confidence because we don't know with certainty that that's even Brittany's father.
Right. Yeah. I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah. I mean I'd feel better if like a DNA sample was taken from Brenda, who we know is related to Brittany's mother. But again, they're only half sisters. So like there just wouldn't be as much of a connection. So I do understand why, you know, police chose this man who they thought was her father. But there really is no question anymore that that body did not belong to Brittany Williams. Because 2 years later in 2005, the little girl who was found was given her name back. She was finally identified as Erica Green, a little girl who was murdered by her mother and stepfather just a month shy of her fourth birthday. And, you know, I do want to actually pause real quick and talk about that because when I first read that, I was like, how on earth, like Brittany was seven, like why would they have ever thought that that was her? But Brittany was very small. Brittany, when she disappeared at 7 years old, was only 3'8" tall and about 65 pounds.
That's really tiny.
So while this line of investigation ended up being a dead end, Kim wasn't giving up any more information that could possibly aid in the search for Brittany. One of the detectives was like, she has been less than helpful. Like if it's possible to give zero help, she's somehow given less. In April of 2003, Kim Parker was indicted on 73 felony fraud charges for continuing to collect medical benefits and private donations for Britney, which totaled over $16,000. At the end of April, she pled not guilty to the charges, but remained in federal custody awaiting her trial. While Kim was incarcerated, police did continue to search. One of the contractors who worked on Kim's home gave them a tip that led investigators to search under that new addition that I had mentioned. The contractor said that there was an unused septic system underneath a new porch. So police went in, dug up her property, and they did look in that septic tank, but no evidence related to Britney was found.
Okay, so disturbing on several levels. Obviously, the implication that she would have thrown her into the unused septic tank.
Yeah.
But also, did you say that the addition that was put onto the house was a porch?
Well, I think, no, that was just like one part of it. It wasn't just a porch.
Okay.
No, yeah.
I was going to say, because that'd be really fucked up.
Yeah, no. But yes, there was a porch involved. In December of 2003, Kim accepted a plea deal and pled guilty to two counts of Social Security fraud in July. During sentencing, the judge told Kim, quote, "While masquerading as a good Samaritan, you are using the victim to perpetrate a fraud on society. Your aptitude for deception reached such a high level, no one seems to really know this side of you," end quote. So she got this sweet plea deal, and the judge did approve the prosecution's request to exceed sentencing guidelines on those two charges, but like her sentence still ended up being much, much less than it could have been. In the end, Kim was sentenced to 8 years in federal prison, and then she later received an additional 2 years for state charges.
But still no charges relating to Britney's disappearance.
Nope, just the money.
Okay.
Because, you know, you can make a child disappear, but God forbid you take money from the government.
Sounds about right.
By 2005, Britney's case was still open, but investigators were losing hope. Investigator Eddie Kopacki told the Associated Press, quote, "I doubt a doctor would say she's held on this long. There's no way for her to get the medication without Medicaid, and we've contacted every state to check," end quote.
Well, at least it sounds like the investigators now are doing their due diligence.
Yeah,
and searching for her.
No, it does seem like they are. I mean, you know, 2.5 years after she's last seen, you know.
Yeah, what are you going to be left with?
Exactly. So what they were left with, you know, is what he said, like contacting every state, contacting social services, contacting, you know, Medicaid offices,
right,
things like that.
Yeah.
You know, contacting hospitals who in clinics who treat AIDS patients. Yeah. So it sounds like they did all that and they just couldn't find her. While police continued to receive tips over the years, they never found any other evidence regarding Britney's whereabouts. Kim Parker was eventually released from prison and moved out of state. She has never given any additional information on Britney to police, to reporters, to anybody. The case of Britney Williams remained cold until a shocking claim in 2021. On August 21st, 2021, almost 21 years to the day after Britney Williams was last seen alive, a woman named Daja made the following all caps post in a Cold Cases Facebook group. Quote, "Britney Renee Williams is alive. She's working with detectives as of the time of this post. They lied. She does not have HIV or AIDS. They lied to collect benefits off of her. She was illegally adopted and brutally abused her whole life. I am married to her. She is in my profile video with me. There are so many lies told in her story," end quote.
The thing that's throwing me is that they lied about her having AIDS.
Yeah, that was what she was claiming.
But isn't there medical proof that she had AIDS? I mean, she had that port put in.
That's true, and that's undisputed. But there is, you know, that could potentially have been for another medical reason.
I don't know how you do that. How you can claim somebody has AIDS and collect benefits for it if there's no medical proof of it.
Right. And some people have answers. So this is just the beginning of a firestorm that erupted on Facebook, on Reddit, you know, on YouTube, eventually, you know, all the way to the Dr. Phil show. Like, this went on, you know, like I said, that post was made in August. This went on until January of this year, and it gets nuts. And it's so twisty and turny and crazy that, unfortunately, we have to just split it up into a two-part episode because this has already kind of gone on for a while. This week, you know, we told you the story of Brittany Williams. Next week, we are going to tell you the story of the woman claiming to be Brittany Williams. So that's what we're talking about next week. But if you are on our Patreon, we will be releasing that episode much sooner, probably right after you finish listening to this one or just a little bit after. Brittany Renee Williams has been missing from Richmond, Virginia since August 18, 2000. Brittany was a biracial female with brown hair and brown eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was 3 feet 8 inches tall and weighed 65 pounds. She has a light complexion and has chickenpox scars on her face. She has a scar on her upper left chest from a portacath tube. Brittany was 7 when she went missing. She would be 29 today. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Brittany Williams, please contact Henrico Police at 804-501-5000. Anonymous tips are welcome through Crime Stoppers at 804-780-1000 or p3tips.com. And that's P as in Paul, the number 3tips.com. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week or right away in Patreon for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.